So, before the teaching starts, there is a tradition of reciting a praise to Lord Buddha stanza, which is a tradition originating from Khuna Lama Rinpoche. Khuna Lama Rinpoche, whenever he gives teaching, he quotes a stanza from different texts, praise for Lord Buddha, but I am not able to recite such verse, so I used to recite the stanza from Nagarjuna's text from the 27th century, remembering the kindness of Lord Buddha, having seen his wisdom. So this verse, when I used to recite, since in the morning I wake up, due to the great compassion and eliminating all the delusions, then thinking about the delusions and which is ignorance, which is the source of all the delusions, and I prostrate to the Gautama Buddha. So this verse I used to think about, and when sometimes when I do not have yet good sleep, so I used to recite this stanza instead of reciting some mantras. From one side, it is the special, unique, beneficial qualities of Lord Buddha, and the stanza is also composed by Nagarjuna, which makes the stanza very unique. So we'll continue from the liberation in the palm of hand. As we repeat yesterday, we have the new revised edition 2006 from the Wisdom publication. When the page number 113, let us now turn to the arrangement of the symbols of enlightened body, speech and mind. The Guru meditation deities, etc., must follow the same order of prudence as in the meritful visualization. However, you can depart a little from this altar if the object will otherwise not fit in the altar. Some people think it more effective to pray to Dharma protectors, spirit kings, spirits of power and the like. They give them a more prominent position than their Buddha statue. I've seen this many times. It is a sign that these people have not taken proper refuge. The act of taking refuge is not within their mind streams. Some people give prior to place for any statue made of gold, silver or bronze, they put the clay figures at the end of the row. This is a sign they only regard these figures as a piece of property. It is also not right to arrange your religious paintings according to their age. Some people even hang their paintings on the curtains they use as doors. How could that be right? There are people who sleep with their feet pointing at the figures of the Buddhas and Bodhisattva. This is being most disrespectful, a clear sign they have not taken refuge at all. You might not have many of these symbols of enlightened body, speech and mind, but to symbolize the enlightened body, you definitely must have a figure of our teacher, the Buddha, so as to be reminded of him, as well as a figure of Jerumbiche to remind you of your guru. So, the wind is blowing and taking away my papers. So when you arrange the image of the Buddha, the representations of the Buddha in your altar, so you have to consider them as the original or the genuine Buddha himself. A short sutra or a copy of Lamrim could serve as a symbol for enlightened speech. A tsatsa will do at a pinch to symbolize the enlightened mind. If you have a watch or a bell, they should stand as a symbol for the enlightened mind. Some people seem to regard watcher's bell as only simple elements yielded by deities. In fact, they represent the enlightened mind. It is a great mistake to undervalue your watcher and bell as not being symbols of the enlightened mind. I think this section is very clear in the Shamar Lamrim. So if we get even a sense of anger or towards an image of a Buddha, then it could really destroy all the virtues that we have accumulated for a long time. So this is very powerful. So when we think about the accumulations for the three countless eons and the power of such accumulations, of course we know that we won't be encounter any kind of activities that we have not gained. But sometimes due to the power of the objects and power of one's object of worship, many things can happen. It is wrong to feel, I already know the figures in my room. What is there to look at? Every time you see them in the course of the day, you are instilled with exceptionally strong instincts. We are told it is 16 times more beneficial to look at a representation of a Buddha than to look at the real thing, as it says in the White Lotus Sutra. When page number 115, Aryashariputra was a messenger in that past life. One night at dusk, he saw a temple and went inside to stay. He lit a very bright old lamp and started to repair his boots when it was time for him to go to sleep. He saw the mural of a Tathagata on the wall opposite him and thought to himself, this is such an amazing being. Why not meet him in prison? He made silent prayers and they say he became a major disciple of Buddha as a result. We now see Buddhas made of clay, brass, and so on, but when we gain the single-pointed concentration called the stream of Dharma, we will see supreme Nirmakayas. And when we reach the first Bodhisattva levels, we will meet the Sambhogakayas in person. This is why it is so important to hold the attitude that Buddha statues are real Buddhas. Here, without deceit refers to an absence of two things, deceit with respect to the object being offered and deceitful motives. Deceit with respect to the object being offered means that some faulty action was committed while one obtained the thing to be offered. That is, either an ordained person obtained the thing by means of five wrong livelihoods or a lay person obtained it through taking life, dealing out short measures, short-changing or some other evil means. It is better not to offer than to offer such things. The Sanskrit for offering is puja, which is the connotation of to please. So the offering you make must be pleasing to the victorious ones and their children. How could they be pleased if you offer these sort of things? All the same, if you have already obtained offering in these above ways, it is good to offer them as a means to purify the sin that naturally followed the act of acquiring these goods. Page number 116. Hinting is telling your behavior things like, the five wrong livelihoods are very extensively explained in the precious garland. So it seems there are a little bit difference in the explanation of these five wrong livelihoods that one present in the precious garland by Nagarjuna and here. Giving in order to receive is giving some trifle in order to receive something better. For example, you must take a ceremonial scarf or a brick of tea to your benefactor or anyone else for that matter, so that they will reward you or make an offering to your monastery on your behalf. In other words, you have gone to the expense of the gift as a means of getting something better in return. We call this baiting the hook nowadays and commit this wrong livelihood intentionally. But if you make a present to your benefactor sincerely and without this motive, it is not a wrong livelihood, even if they reward you. Exerting pressure on others means pestering someone for something they do not want to give you, or getting someone to give you something they were going to give someone else. Or you could indirectly ask for a gift by saying, "My benefactor so-and-so gave me some tea and butter, which was a big help." But if you say these things out of sincerity, without any motive of receiving gift as a result, it is not the wrong livelihood of exerting pressure. Being on one's best behavior means doing whatever you like in the privacy of your own room, but acting like a good monk who observes all the rules in front of your benefactors in the hope they will give you something because of your disciplined behavior. But my own precious Lama, my refuge and protector, told me that if you do not have these motives and instead feel it wouldn't be right to upset this lay person and behave like a good monk in contrast to the way you behave at home, you're not being on your best behavior. Another point, should altering people such as ourselves break the restrictions pertaining to the three types of vows we have taken and obtain materials through selling things, there will be a heavier consequences than benefit if we use these materials in an offering. Deceitful motives means making offerings out of a desire for fame or to impress others. In other words, one's actions are tainted with bad motives. As Drogon Rinpoche says, even the offerings you make to the three jewels are done only to be seen by others. Page number 117. If someone were expected in your house today, you will sweep it out more conscientiously and put out more offerings on your altar than usual. You would also offer a butter lamp and fill the house with sweet-smelling incense. Investigate carefully your motivation and for those for whose benefit this respect is being paid. It is very difficult to tell whether the offering will benefit or harm you. Kishiben Gungkil was told one day that a benefactor was coming to see him. Kishiben set up the best offering to the three jewels he could manage. He sat down on his meditation mat and examined his motives. He saw that he had made the offering to impress his benefactor. He sprang off his mat and threw ash all over the offering, saying, "Oh monk, sit down and don't try to fool yourself." He left his offering covered with piles of ash. Page number 118. You must put the offering out yourself with your own hands. If you make your pupils or servants arrange the offerings, you will not receive any of the merits. When Atisha was extremely ill, he will offer water bowls, even though his legs are unsteady. People will tell him, "Oh Atisha, that's too much for you. We will put them out for you." Adisha's reply was, "So when I eat, shouldn't you be telling me, 'Oh Atisha, that's too difficult,' and eat my portion of food for me?" When the great Dharmaraja of ancient India practiced great acts of generosity, they would not delegate some minister or other official to distribute the gifts. Instead, the Raja will erect a pavilion and then sit inside, surrounded by piles of jewels for distribution, which he himself would personally hand out. This was called the extraordinary practice of generosity. So it is most important that we put out an offering with our own hands. You should also offer the first portion of your food, but only the best portions. You should not offer the withered parts of your vegetables, or if you are rich, the malty parts of your Tibetan tea. We tend to save the best butter and barley flour for ourselves and set aside the worst, but saying, that's only for the offerings. Isn't that like sweeping away our merits? All the same, butter lamps are an offering of light, not of melted butter. So they say it's quite all right to offer slightly rancid butter. Page number 119. The eight corresponding benefits are said to be the following. Your ethics will be pure because the water you offer is cool. Because it is also delicious, you will come to enjoy most delicious food. The lightness of the water means your mind and body will become fit. The water's softness results in a gentle mind stream. A clear mind results from the water's clearness. Its odorless will purify you of obscurations. And because the water does not hurt the stomach, your body will be free of illness. It is being easy on the throat means you will come to have pleasant speech. When Trupkang Gyeshe Gyatso first moved into a retreat house belonging to Sarachi College, he had very few belongings and provisions. He did not even have a set of bowls for his water offering. In order to make this offering, he had to give his own eating bowl a good wash and then pour his water offering into it. If he wanted to drink tea, he would first ask the precious three jewels for leave to borrow the bowl. He would then use it, and when he had finished his tea, he would rewash the bowl and make another water offering. You can mentally offer anything at all. It could be some of flowers, fruit, clear and cool water, and so forth. My own precious guru told me you could also consecrate the offering by reciting the Dharani for the cloud of offerings. Offer them, then finally dedicate the virtue and so on. Refer to Tri Dagpa Sebel's biography on the practice. In any case, your faith is the main factor, not the things you offer. Page number 120. If all you have for offering are finger-sized ritual cakes and half a stick of incense, do not underestimate their worth. You will increase your merits if you offer them. Later, this merit will bring you materials to make much grander offerings. This is illustrated by Gyeshe Puchungwa's life story. As Gyeshe Puchungwa himself said, at first, I only burned gentian for incense. I offered so much, it made my eyes water. Later, I had sweat-smelling incense made out of four ingredients. These days, I offer the fragrance of Mairabalan, Duraka, and so on. In fact, he once offered 22 gold coins worth of incense. Still, some might claim Gyeshe Puchungwa was a realized being who devoted himself entirely to meditation. Do not hope for enlightenment from such external actions. Such claims show they have very little acquaintance with the Dharma. You should think about the fact that bodhisattvas who have reached one of the 10 levels make offerings to the victorious ones for eons by means of hundreds of thousands of emanated bodies, each with hundreds or even thousands of arms. Surely you with your single body ought to strive to make as many offerings as you can. Page number 121. Adopting the eight feature sitting posture or whatever posture is convenient for you on a comfortable seat and then taking refuge, developing bodhicitta and so on. In an especially virtuous frame of mind, making sure that these practices properly suffuse your mind stream. The rear of your meditation cushion should be slightly raised and the front slightly lower. This has a profound tantric significance. It will also prevent pain in your buttocks and other problems while you sit in meditation for long periods. You should draw a clockwise swastika under the mat in white chalk powder. The swastika stands for the watcher cross and reminds you of that part of Buddha's life story when he sat on the Vajra throne at Bodh Gaya. It also symbolizes that your practice will become firm. However, it is not proper to sit on a real Vajra cross, as this is one of the symbolic implements held by tutelary deities. Place the Durva grass and Kusha grass at front tip of swastika. Again, the source of this practice is the Buddha's life story. The Buddha attained enlightenment on the seat of grass. The dhruva grass increases your lifespan. It is said, dhruva increases the lifespan. That is, your life is lengthened by sitting on it. Also, we are told kusha is clean and virtuous. In other words, kusha is a substance that eliminates pollution and uncleanliness. When Indian Brahmins receive the caste pollution, they will spend a night in a patch of kusha grass. Spread kusha under your cushion to eliminate such things. Page number 122. The legs are in the vajra position. It is also permissible to sit in a half lotus or merely cross-legged in the bodhisattva posture. However, the vajra position is mandatory for the tantric completion stage meditation. Place your two hands in the gesture of meditative absorption. The right hand lies in the left. The tips of two thumbs touch it about navel level. Your back should be straight with the vertebrae as straight as a stack of coins. We are told that energy wind channels are strengthened when the body is straight, strengthening the energy winds flowing through them, making the mind more amenable. The teeth and lips should not be too clenched or too loose, so it is best to leave them in their natural position. Place the tip of your tongue on your palate so that your mouth does not dry out. Also, when you enter deep meditative absorption, it will prevent your saliva from running out of your mouth and so on. Page number 123. The eighth feature is the act of counting your breath. When the primary mind is non-virtuous, its accompanying secondary mental factors are non-virtuous as well. In this situation, it is difficult to summon up an extremely virtuous frame of mind. For example, you may mechanically go through the motions of developing bodhicitta while you are extremely angry and recite for the sake of all sentient beings who were my mothers, but you will not summon up a virtuous mental direction while the primary mind is unvirtuous and its accompanying mental factors have become unvirtuous. You should instead change your mental state into a neutral one, then it will be easier to change to a virtuous mental state. For example, suppose a piece of cotton is white but with black stains. Such a cloth is difficult to dye another color. But if you give the cotton material a good wash in water, it then becomes completely white and is much easier to dye red, yellow or whatever color you like. Page number 124. You may not have to count your breath, but you must nevertheless summon up a virtuous mental state at the beginning of your meditation session. When you commence any virtuous practice, it is vital to set your motivation correctly at the start. Great Tsongkhapa wrote his question on the whitest altruism of all, in which he indicates a number of things to the meditation masters of Tibet. One of the questions was, what is as important at the start of a meditation as the words in Sanskrit? The Panchen Lama Losan Chukyi Gyantsen answered this and other questions in his text, Melodious Laughter of Losan, answers to questions on the whitest altruism of all. Before any meditation, examine one's mental stream properly, just as the words in Sanskrit should appear at the start of a text. This is what you meant, O Peerless Guru. Page number 125. In other words, if you are motivated by delusions, page number 125. In other words, if you are motivated by delusion, any study, contemplation or meditation you do will only ripen into a most undesirable karmic result. But if you are motivated by novel thoughts, even if you commit some non-virtuous actions such as killing, it will be a great impetus to the completion of your accumulation. Vishnu 126. The Brahman lost his temper and said, "If I had the chance, I would cut off the heads of all the Shakyamuni's holy men and leave them to rot on the ground." The Kshatriya had developed faith in because he had received so much food. "If I had the means," he said, "I would like to give Buddha and his Sangha food that tastes 100 different ways every day." They've been walking while they talk to each other, and by now they've reached the city of Saravasti. They took a knife in front of a tree. A runaway cart passed by them, and its wheels cut off the Brahman's head. At the same time, a merchant died in Saravasti. He had had no son, and all the free men of Saravasti met to decide who had the greatest merit for the person who met the merchant's heir. They found the Kshatriya asleep. He was always in the tree's shadow, even though the other tree's shadow had since moved. They made him head of the merchant. The Kshatriya was as good as his word and made donation to Buddha and Sangha. He listened to the Dharma and came to see the truth. As it says in that particular sutra, the mind takes precedence over other things. The mind works quickly, it is paramount. However poison is the mind, anything one says or does will follow suit and will begin suffering. Like the head severed by the will, however pure is the mind, anything one says or does will follow suit and will beget happiness. Page number 127. The difference in our motivation makes an enormous difference to the sort of virtuous karmic results we will receive and to the measure of strength of these results. Suppose four persons are reciting together the praise of the 21 Taras. One is bodhicitta as a motive. Another is motivated by renunciation. The third yearns for a better rebirth. The last one aspires to the consent of this life, long life, good health, and so on. Although all four recite the same amount of verse, there is great difference in the sort of karmic results they will obtain. There's some spelling mistake here. Second person's recitation was done in concert. Page number 128. The meditator's motivation also determines whether the meditation will have any point. This, in your study, contemplation and meditation, your practice of sadhanas, your generosity with offerings, praise and gifts and so on, if you do not adopt the right motives to practice virtue, be it large or small, the entire practice will amount to nothing. You must therefore be serious about adopting the right motives at the outset. Further, as this is Mahayana Dharma, mere virtuous intentions are not sufficient. Please turn off the fan. In the afternoon is much hotter, so maybe it's better to on the fan in the afternoon. So it's not necessary to on the fan all the time. If your bodhicitta is unforced, it will develop its own accord, and you will not have to do the following. If your bodhicitta is of the first variety, you must consciously activate it. Your mind will not change its course if without any further preparation you merely recite, for the sake of all sentient beings. Instead, you should begin with something like, I have obtained the optimum human rebirth, and end with, I shall meditate upon this discourse on the stages of path to enlightenment. I dealt with this a few days ago. In other words, you should walk your way in an orderly fashion from the subject of the difficulty of obtaining the optimum human rebirth to the section on the development of bodhicitta. Your mind will then be transformed. Page number 129. So while in this specially virtuous mental state, you should now take refuge and generate bodhicitta. But take care, I am combining three Lamrim texts in this discourse, and you must not get confused, for each text has its own version of the preparatory rites, the refuge visualization, and the merit field. It is current practice to use the preparatory rites according to the southern lineage vision in assemblies because of its convenience. However, you ought to use the swift path version in your daily recitation. To take refuge, you first have to evoke the refuge visualization. The swift path version of this visualization goes as follows. Visualize in the space in front of you a huge and precious throne supported by eight huge lions. If you situate the throne too high, your mind will become too excited. If it is too low, you will become too dull. Ideally, the throne should be level with the gap in your eyebrows. So these are all practices that we need to undertake daily and contemplate on. So if we do not have the experience based on our daily practice, then of course all these teachings will be just a kind of the sake of reading without having any practice. Page number 130. On the throne in front of Buddha sits your root guru. This time it is normal aspect. You do not visualize his physical faults. For example, he may be blind in real life. His right hand is in the gesture of teaching Dharma. His left in the gesture of meditating absorption. A life-giving initiation vase, full of nectar of immortality, sits on the palm of his hand. The two gestures indicate that he is a Buddha, for he can teach Dharma while absorbed in meditating on profound emptiness. The teaching Dharma gesture also encourages his disciples to study. The meditative absorption gesture encourages them to put their studies into practice. Great Tsongkhapa said, the main obstacles for the fortunate in their practice of the path to liberation are delusion, which defeats the mind, and yama, which defeats the body. Page number 131. In this visualization, your gurus who are still alive sit on cushions. Those who have already died sit on lotuses and mundigs. We shall be using the term the five sets of gurus because the gurus in this visualization sit in five groups. The other figures of the merit field, from tutelary deities to Dharma protectors, surround these gurus. These other figures are on the largest throne. In my own precious guru's oral tradition, the meditation deities are positioned around the five sets of gurus. This follows tutor Sejokling Rinpoche's practice. The deities of the innermost circle are of highest yoga tantra. They are surrounded by the yoga tantra deities. Then come those of the charya tantra and finally the kriya tantra. So there are four concentric rings of deities. Chusang Lama Yishigombo put the four types of deities in the four cardinal directions. Highest yoga tantra in front, yoga tantra to the central Buddha's right, and so on. Owing to this arrangement, in drawings of Chusang's version of the merit field visualization, only the highest yoga tantra deities are visible. In any case, the meditation deities are surrounded by the Buddhas taking their supreme Nirmakaya form. Prominent in this group are thousand Buddhas of this fortunate eon, the eight Tathagatas, the 35 Buddhas of confession, and so on. The point of doing this is as follows. There are in general infinite numbers of Buddhas. However, we have the strongest relationship with the Buddhas of this fortunate eon. We are told that prayers to the other seven Tathagatas made during the reign of teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha will succeed. The 35 Buddhas of confession have great powers to purify sins and broken vows. The Buddhas are in turn surrounded by the Bodhisattvas, such as the 8 closest children, and so on. They take the form of divine princes. The Bodhisattvas are surrounded by Pratigya Buddhas, such as the 12 Pratigya Buddhas. They are surrounded by the Sharvakas, the 16 elders of the Arahats, and so on. All these take the form of monks. They display the good qualities of purity and hold begging bowls, iron stubs, and palm leaf books in their hands. Sharvakas can be distinguished from the Pratigya Buddhas by the slightly smaller protrusion on the crown of their heads. In fact, this group displays marks similar to the marks and signs of Buddha. The Sharvakas are surrounded by Dagas and Dakinis such as Kandak Kapila and Prachandali. They take the form described in the Heruka Tantra. We are on page number 132. There are 2 oral traditions concerning the 4 Maharajas of the 4 cardinal points of the compass. One tradition places them on the main throne. The other tradition has them standing on cloud cushions below this throne. The reasons for these are as follows. The first tradition regards these 4 Maharajas to be super maintained figures. The second gives them only maintained status. It is wrong to include petty mundane figures like spirit king in this visualization. One Salamat Sechokling Rumbishi, a tutor to one of the Dalai Lama, was shown a painting of this merit field. The artist has drawn a spirit king among the protectors. Rumbishi pointed a finger at it and said, if only he had painted a wish-granting jewel there instead. Visualize loosely books on the Dharma in front of each of the figure in this refuge visualization. The books are by nature the jewel of realized Dharma, but take the form of books, that is, the transmitted Dharma. The books are wrapped in water silks with brocade bookmarks. Visualize this. These books are teaching you Dharma. There are many versions of the refuge visualization. One tradition has all 3 jewels embodied in one figure. Other versions have various figures standing on different horizontal levels. However, the above description has all the necessary symbolism that relates to 3 jewels. But note, this visualization is not two-dimensional like a painting. Nor are the figures solid like clay statues. They are rainbow bodies whose nature is clear, bright light. They are there in person and radiate brilliant light. In the transmission of the Vinaya, we find 3 similes in praise of the enlightened body. Page number 133. The figures are also debating the Dharma among themselves. In fact, there is a great deal of activity going on. Some of them are arriving while others leave to perform various tasks. There is much coming and going, rather like people on royal business going back and forth through the gates of a king's palace. The figures from Shakyamuni Buddha to the Maharajas are sending out emanations for the sake of sentient beings, while other emanations are returning to them. Each pair of these figures is also a Buddha field, and so on. The visualization must be as detailed as you can imagine. You should also think that the figure in this marriage field are extremely pleased with you. As Dukhang Gelek Gyatso says, you don't usually do the things the victorious ones and their children tell you to do it. Instead, you do the things they tell you not to. So they have no occasion to be pleased with you. But now you are doing a little to please them. Suppose a mother has a son who continually does only bad things. If he does something good for once, it pleases his mother more than anything else could. We also continually do only the wrong things. But here we are attempting to meditate on the Lamrim. This pleases the victorious ones and their children more than anything else could. Page number 134, third para. They say that when you recite the fourfold refuge formula in public ceremonies, you should repeat it in sequence. That is, I take refuge in the Guru, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha, I take refuge in the Guru, and so forth. But when you are taking refuge during your meditations, you should repeat each part of the formula a number of times on its own, so that the refuge visualization will appear more easily. So when you are repeating, I take refuge in the Guru, you focus your attention on the five sets of Gurus and take refuge while the purifying nectars descend from them. Suppose you are going to recite one rosary's worth of this part of the formula. For the first 50 repetitions, you must visualize that the nectars purify you of non-dharmic qualities. During the last 50 repetitions, you visualize that your dharmic qualities increase. Thus, for the first half of the recitation, you imagine that the five types of color nectars, together with lights of the five colors, descend from the Gurus. The white nectar predominates. They enter your own body and mind and all the bodies and minds of the others. The nectars purify all the sins and obscurations that you and they have accumulated since beginningless time. This applies especially to actions such as endangering your Guru's body, disobeying his orders, disturbing his mental peace, disparaging him and not having faith in him. In short, all the sins and obscurations you have acquired in relation to your Guru, this all owes from your body in the form of smoky and cold black sludge, and you feel you have been completely purified. Page number 137. In the second half, the part where you increase your good qualities, imagine that the 10 powers, the 4 fearlessnesses, and the 18 unique qualities take the form of descending nectar. The rest is the same as above. Then you recite, I take refuge in the Dharma. The purifying nectars descend from the books in the visualization. This nectar is by nature the realized Dharma. The sins we accumulate in relation to Dharma are abandoning holy Dharma, selling scriptures, not showing scriptures enough respect, profiting from the sale of a book, consuming the profit from a book, etc. We are very much in danger of committing these sins, and they have extremely heavy consequences. Abandoning Dharma is, in the final analysis, disparaging the Hinayana because of the Mahayana, favoring the Hinayana on account of Mahayana, playing off Sutra against Tantra, playing off the four classes of Tantra against each other, favoring out of the Tibetan schools, the Sakya, Gelug, Kagyu or Nyingma, and disparaging the rest, and so on. In other words, we abandon Dharma anytime we favor our own tenets and disparage the rest. We also abandon Dharma when we step our text on writing, throw any writing away, and so forth. Some people even do things like sitting on writing. They deliberately accumulate evil karma by doing so. Abandoning the Dharma is an extremely heavy misdeed, as we are told in the King of Single-Pointed Concentration Sutra and many sutras, but I have already covered this in great detail. Selling scriptures means buying and selling them with the attitude that they are material goods. You do not treat scriptures with enough respect. If you put them on the floor without a reverent cloth, if you pick your teeth and use the plate to stick colored piece of paper to the pages, lick your fingers to turn a page, or put things on top from among Dharma books. These two are extremely heavy misdeeds. When Atisha was in Ngari, he and a tantris who rejected his teaching, so a scribe used his finger to pick his teeth and then stick a color patch on the path of a Dharma book. Adisha could not bear to see it. Page number 138. He turned to the Tantris and said, "Oh, how wrong you! How wrong! How wrong! They say this street the Tantris' faith in Adisha, so much so that he then took teachings from him. People like ourselves, who are always handling books, should be particularly careful. We always run the risk of committing these misdeeds at all costs. If you use a thing bought with the proceeds gained from selling a book, you have consumed the profit. This also has heavy consequences." The fifth of the seven Shambharimbiche, Huenten Kesamba, was a great adept in Avalokiteshvara Tantra. His benefactor, a layman, ran short of money and sold a set of 100,000 verse perfection of Wisdom Sutra. What's the time now? It's only 10:30 now.
Arya Sangha consists of people who directly perceive emptiness. It's page 939 in the new edition. Its members may be lay people, or monks, or nuns, for ordinary beings who have not perceived emptiness this way are deemed to Sangha, to be Sangha, if the Pratimoksha vows are still pure. But whether the members of the Sangha are ordinary or not, they could divide into two groups of at least four members each over some disagreement, because someone indulges in divisive talk that causes friction between the two groups. Everyone involved, not merely the person causing the dissension, will go hand in hand to the lower realms. There was once a Kadamba Geshe in Sedshe who caused dissension among the Sangha. Later, after the Geshe's death, Geshe Domtenpa remarked, "If my disciple Sedshe had died 3 years earlier, he would have died as an upholder of the three baskets, but he died 3 years too late. His monastery, Thirpur, said Dom, was his undoing." And according to the oral tradition of Lama teachers, Sedshe is still in hell, the place where the schism is committed, is also said to be scorched by the sin. Other people will not be able to develop realization at that place, even if they practice there for 12 years. Hostility and attachment can divide the Sangha into cliques whose members think in terms of us and them, and if only there were more people on our side. I think this is the main cause of friction. If the members of the Sangha do not get on ready, reading, study, contemplation, or contemplation cannot flourish, nor yet the dhyana concentration, states that they could use to abandon manifest delusions. The worst damage such friction can cause is bringing the teaching into decline. One sutra says, harmonious Sangha is happy. The asceticism of those in harmony is easy. This quotation tells us, in other words, that the main thing members of the Sangha must do is get along. Stealing offerings made to the Sangha is misappropriating the Sangha's Sangha's funds not turning over to the Sangha, Texas, levied in its name, Sangha members keeping and using something meant for the Sangha, Sangha's general use, etc. The administrators of monasteries are most vulnerable to these things. Some monks whose job is lies with the monasteries, benefactors, act as though they're more concerned for the benefactor, and so might tell him, we don't need to all of this. This is an act of depriving the Sangha. Depriving the Sangha of even a slice of butter. Slice of butter is stealing from the mouth of the general community. It is a cause for being born in the hell without respite. Other forms of embezzling from the Sangha result in the rebirth in the surrounding hells. This is illustrated by the story of Arya Sangharakshita. While returning from a visit to the Naga regions, he saw some beings in an occasional hell by the ocean shore. These hell beings took many shapes and forms. Some looked like rope, some like clay pot, others like brooms, bezels, pillars, walls, and even a water pipe. They were all wailing and making heart-rending moans. Sangharakshita later asked the Buddha, what was the karma that ripened into these results? The Buddha told him, following the hell creatures who were like ropes and brooms were once people who withheld ropes and brooms from the Sangha when the teachings of Kashyapa Buddha were still in existence. The ropes of the brooms, were meant for the Sangha's general use, but these people set them aside for their own personal use. The creature who looked like a clay pot was once a lay helper of the Sangha. He was boiling up some medicine in a clay pot, and some monks made unpleasant remarks to him. He lost temper and broke the pot. This was the result of that action. The peasant creature was once a monk. He ordered a novice, one scheduled for debate, to grind him some roasted grain. The novice was busy and said he would do it in a little while. The monk lost his temper and said, if I could get hold of a basil, I would pound you and never mind what about the roasted grain. He was reborn in the shape of basil. As a result of these insulting words, the beings looking like walls and pillars were once people who had done inappropriate things, which the saliva and mucus in temples of Sangha. The creature who looked like a water pipe had tiny waist. This was the ripening effect of the following karma. He used to be a contractor who starved the Sangha by not distributing the supplies meant for the summer until the following autumn. Thus, if you take something belonging to the Sangha without permission, even so much as a stick from the Sangha's wood pile, you will... you are sure to be reborn in occasional hell. Criticizing the Sangha means abusing its members with harsh words, calling them by names and so on, either to their faces or behind their backs. A Brahmin called Manava Kapila insulted members of Kashyapa Buddha's Sangha. He was born as a type of sea monster. Here is a brief version of his history. In India, there was once 500 fishermen who used to cast their net in the Gandaka River to catch fish, turtles, and so on. One day, a sea monster got caught in one of the nets. His body was enormous. The 500 fishermen were unable to land the monster while it drifted into the current. They asked cowards, grass cutters, harvest workers, and passers-by for help. Hundreds of thousands of people lent hand, and the thing was dragged ashore. They saw that it had 18 heads and 36 eyes. Among the crowds were six Tirthika teachers and other such people. Buddha, who can perceive anything regardless of when it happened, went there to make a pronouncement concerning the laws of cause and effect. He was accompanied by many monks of his Sangha. Scoffers said, the holy man Gautama claims to be above such vulgar spectacles, yet here he comes. People who believed in him said, the Buddha is above such things. The Buddha will take this opportunity to teach some wonderful Dharma to the people here. A throne was set up. The Buddha sat on it, surrounded by his retinue. He blessed the monster so they could recall its past lives and understand human speech. Buddha then said to it, you are Manav Kapila, are you not? Yes, it said, I am Kapila. Are you undergoing a ripening of some misdeed of body, speech, and mind? I am. Who misguided you? My mother. Where was she reborn? In hell. How were you reborn? As an animal. When you die, where will you be reborn? I'll be reborn in hell. And at that, the creature began to cry. The Buddha's retinue was completely astonished at their insistence, and Ananda asked who this creature was that could remember its past life and speak in human tongue. Buddha had recited this story once in the time of Kashyapa Buddha during the reign of King Krikan. Some Brahmins came from another country and challenged people to debate. A Brahmin called Kapilashanti defeated the other philosophers in debate, and the king gave him the deed to the mountain where the debate was held. The Brahmin's son had long blonde hair and was therefore named Manav Kapil. Now, this son studied the art of writing and so on, and became a scholar who had also defeat others in debate. His father died, and his mother feared that other people might take from him the prizes he had won in debates. She asked her son, "Can you defeat all philosophers in debate?" "I can defeat anyone except Kashyapa's holy man," he replied. "Go and defeat even them," she said. Out of the respect for his mother, he went out to debate with them. He met a monk who asked him what a certain verse meant. He could not come up with an answer. He developed faith in Sangha and returned home. "Did you defeat the holy man?" asked his mother. "Mother, if there had been any witnesses today, I would have been defeated." "Son, in that case, read Buddha scriptures. They are kept from lay people. Then become ordained. After you become a scholar, give up your monkhood." She was so insistent that he took ordination and became scholar of the three baskets. Again, his mother asked, "Did you defeat these holy men?" "Mother, I have only received the transmission of the teachings. They have both the transmission and realization into teaching. I cannot defeat them." "Son, no matter how much Dharma you have been taught, in debate use insulting words against them. They are fearful of committing any misdeed and will not say anything at all in retaliation. People will think that you have won the debate." Kapil did as she instructed. When he debated with the mother, so he lost his temper and said, "Elephant head, how could you know what is Dharma and what is not?" He also called them horse head, camel head, donkey head, bull head, monkey head, lion head, tiger head, and so on. So with regard to the three trainings, they are common to shared with the non-Buddhist traditions as well. The Christians also have these practices of morality. In some way in Greece, I've heard that there's some Orthodox Christians who do some meditation. I don't know the details. The non-Buddhist traditions of India have meditation. They have the practice of morality, meditative concentration, and also vipassana and wisdom. And so they have the mundane vipassana. And so this means they have the three trainings. But in the Buddhist three trainings are called the higher trainings, and this word higher is applied, and it has this reference to the understanding of emptiness, the view of emptiness. And so with the qualified by this understanding of selflessness, when you do the practice of morality, then the morality becomes the higher morality and training of morality. And similarly, it is the case with concentration. And then with regard to wisdom, the training of wisdom, it becomes higher wisdom when it is imbued with this understanding of selflessness. So such was Buddha's pronouncement. It is also wrong to disparage ordinary members of the Sangha. People may say, for example, they're deprived monks. But as I have already mentioned, there is no difference between four ordinary beings who are monks and Arya Sangha. Would there be any difference in saying these things to Maitreya or Manjushri? We treat members of Sangha of our own social class for far too off-handedly. We might say, I take refuge in the Sangha, but we act differently. As by my own precious Lama said, when ordained ones sit among the row, they should all regard one another, the monks on their left and right, as their refuge. But this is not what they in fact do. Instead, they pick faults with one another, but each other. They think to themselves, so and so, the old monk in the middle of that row is very stingy. Such and such, the monk behind him is even worse, such a foul temper, and so on. They think every member of Sangha has this and that fault, and taking a cynical turn in their mindstream, they conclude none of them are better than me. But the formula, I take refuge in the Sangha, applies to the whole Sangha to be found in the 10 directions. Perhaps you ought to compose your very own refuge formula. Might I suggest I take refuge in the Sangha, except for this person, that person, Lama Khon Chokya and Yanlok said, whenever you see your true friends, the Arya Sangha, remember they are true friends to help you on your way. In other words, whenever you meet members of the ordinary Sangha or the Arya Sangha, you must regard them as refuge, as people who help you leave place of danger. So what is taught in the Abhisamaya Alamkara and Mahayana Uttara Tantra about the Buddha nature, these are very important. When we talk about becoming a Buddha, we cannot talk about some inanimate object becoming a Buddha, but someone who has this experience of mind to become enlightened. And so as the Mahayana Uttara Tantra says, everyone has the enlightened activities of the Buddha always radiate towards sentient beings, and the sentient beings have this Buddha nature within them. And their empty nature of the mind and the Buddha's empty nature of mind have no difference. So of course, just thinking that so you have to be very sure about visualizing yourself as deities. If you just think, oh, I am a deity, it doesn't really work. If you just pretend to be, visualizing yourself as a deity, then it will not be. You will not be able to see yourself as deity. And if actually you, while remaining this ordinary being, think that you are right a deity, that doesn't work either. So you have to. Jesab Rinpoche, in one of his texts, says that while actually keeping this solid, the ordinary perception solidly there within yourself, still thinking that I am a deity is actually a wrong perception, a mistaken perception. And so you have to do practice of emptiness, and from within that meditation you have to arise into the deities. And so I take refuge in the Guru, meditation deities, and the three jewels accompanying this with the visualization of descending purification nectar. We are told the visualization of descending purification nectar is tantric tradition. The descent of purifying light rays is sutric. The purifying nectars can descend in three ways. They can come to you within a tube of light. They can come down, wind down around rays of light, or they can descend in heavenly rain. Next, you recite an ornament. Now, recite, until enlightenment, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. With the merit I earn through generosity and service, may I gain Buddhahood for the sake of all beings. I take refuge in the first part, and develop your Bodhicitta further. When you say, with the merit I earn through the generosity and so forth, things to yourself that... Uh, by virtue of the root merit I have acquired through practicing generosity, maintaining my ethics, practicing patience, and so on, may I gain brotherhood for the sake of all sentient beings. I do not have to give any further details on this now, for I shall discuss in detail later how to internalize this topic. The taking refuge is like becoming a king, king's subject. Developing bodhicitta is like offering him tribute. At this point, you must visualize the taking result of your development of bodhicitta as part of your path. You do this as follows. Our Guru Shakyamuni emerges a duplicate image of himself that dissolves into you. You become Shakyamuni by nature, that is Buddha. Countless Shakyamuni emanates from you and dissolve into sentient beings who also become Shakyamuni by nature. They too are now Buddhas. Rejoice and feel. When I develop bodhicitta, I thought to myself, I will lead all sentient beings to the state of Buddhahood. Now I have achieved my aim. This visualization simulates the result of developing bodhicitta, that you have been completely successful in the tantras and the mandalas. Performing this visualization has corresponding benefit, and it also contains all the distinctive, profound key points to be found in teachings, like shaking the depths of samsara or purification of six types of sentient beings and their abodes. Next, you meditate on the four immeasurables. Thing as follows. But I'm actually unable to take all sentient beings as to such a state. I can only do this in my visualization. So what is to blame for this? My feelings of attachment for beings on my side and feelings of hostility for those on the other side. How welcome it would be if all sentient beings remained in a state of equanimity, free of feelings of intimacy or distance, detachment or hostility. May they come to this state. I will bring them to this state. May I be blessed by my gurus and deities to have the power to do this. So as I remember, it is not easy. Kirub Nosan Gyatso became enlightened in one lifetime. For over 40 years, he actually remained as a hermit and meditated in the hills. And then the first Dalai Lama, Gendun Drupa, and him were the son, teacher, and disciple. And so, with regard to finding the view of emptiness, the second Dalai Lama actually was influenced by Chidum Nosan Gyatso. And he has written, the second Dalai Lama, Gendun Gyatso, has written that the Chidum Nosan Gyatso was to become enlightened for soon. So I'm quite skeptical about becoming enlightened within 3 years, 3 months, and three weeks, and so forth. And so, so I say that it's better to think of becoming enlightened in many eons instead of this 3 year, 3 months thing. And so Jinzen Miller Rinpa, when he met one Lama, who told him that I have a teaching instruction which can liberate you if you meditate in the daytime you can become liberated in the nighttime if you meditate at night. And so he thought, oh, I actually was able to accomplish the black magic very easily. So perhaps I am a fortunate one. Therefore, I may not need to put much effort, I can sleep. So he slept. And then the teacher actually told him that you are not the disciple that I could help, but actually you should go to Marpa, who could actually help. And therefore, Jujuy Melarepa went to Marpa, and Marpa actually put him to a great task. And put him through great hardships. And so becoming enlightened is not something not easy. So when you say here that oh, you can become enlightened in 3 years, 3 months, and so forth, with great excitement, you might go into some retreat, and then you are not able to gain that enlightenment after doing those 3 year, 3 month, and so forth meditation, and then you lose, you become discouraged. Many Westerners and foreigners actually do that. Instead of thinking to become, expecting to become enlightened in 3 years, 3 months, and so forth, meditation, you should actually think of cultivating the path over long a period of time, like the three eons, the countless eons, and so forth. And you have to have the courage to train yourself. However long it takes you to become enlightened, you should have that determination to carry on with your practice. And then with regard to the bodhicitta, as Shantideva has said, which intelligent one would actually become despondent and think to ride on the horse of bodhicitta, which leads you from happiness to happiness. And also we do this succession yoga practice. If you actually become really sincere in this about it, thinking, saying that I will give my body, speech, and mind the roots of virtue and resources and so forth for all sentient beings. And then, so you should actually persevere in your practice, even if it takes long time. But persevere and develop those paths and within yourself. And if and then you will not lose heart because you are determined to carry on with your practice as long as it takes to reach the goal. And therefore, and so if you are able to put effort, then of course if within perhaps it's possible for you to become enlightened and to pass progress along the path in a short period of time as well. And so I usually say that 3 month retreat meditation is like the Chinese communist propaganda. So we have to be realistic and practical. You should not have too much expectation. And when your expectation is not fulfilled as you desired, then you would either give up the practice or have misconception about the practice and the teaching. You lose faith and have wrong views. So here it is with reference to Gotsangpa. In relation to Gyawa Gotsangpa, someone who is like him or Jizumilarepa, you could become enlightened within 3 years, 3 months, and 3 weeks, or so forth. And so, and there it also goes through the text goes through the names, Ensapa and so forth, who have become enlightened within one lifetime following the garden tradition of Master Tsongkhapa. So now we are at a point which talks about the visualizing the merit field. Where most of us do do the Lama Sherpa, the Guru Puja. So in many practices, you actually visualize the Lama in this main your root Lama in the center, and the rest of the Lamas actually surrounding him, flanking him around. Surrounding him, whereas in the Seju practice, you have the Garden Hajjama practice, which is which has the visualizations of Jerembuche, and then in at his heart, you visualize the Manjushri, and then you also recite the Miktema name praise of Guru Jerembuche. And so there's no need to visualize so many deities, but to have your Lama who is embodies, who you should perceive as embodying all the objects of refuge. And the main practice is to subdue and discipline your mind. And so if you can do it even with one single Lama, visualizing him as embodiment of all the refuges, it could also work. So if you have too many deities in your visualization, you are, perhaps you may not be able to focus on the main practice itself. Your time would be spent more on thinking and spending on identifying each of these deities and lamas and so forth, and so their features and so forth as well. So with regard to the Dharma Raja, is called the Karma Yama, mainly Jerembuchi's practice is based on the inner Karma Yama, and he wrote this praise called Kyangkumma, which is actually a praise to the inner Karma Yama. So below your own gurus are the multicolored lotus flowers and so forth. It's on page 148. And on the central flower stands 600 armed Makala Ponasandis. He's in his Kulajana form. He's the Lord of Dharma of the Great Scope. To his right hand stands Vaishravana on the lotus flower mount. He's Lord of Dharma of the medium scope. The Makala is left, and Karmayama on the sun disk and lotus flower. He's Lord of the Karma of small scope. The reasons for taking them as Lords of Dharma are of the three scopes of these. The Kurukula Jhana form of Makala is really Avalokiteshvara, the embodiment of compassion of all the victorious ones and rising in the form of protector deity. The point being made here is that one will sooner develop love and compassion while following the And so we are on page 100, day 5. At the end of the day 4, it says this particular lineage. So other protectors stand on the right and left of the three lots of the three scopes. Those three lots should also be placed so that the lotus bases stand at different levels. At the position of internalizing taking refuge and the rest the same as above, and there will be more below. This particular lineage then adds a passage, petitions to refuge. This passage runs, Guru and precious three jewels, I take refuge in you and pay my homage. Please bless my mind stream. It is based on great Sakya, the precious Sakya, oral traditions. And then day 5, Pabankar Dojishan gave a short talk on on how we should set our motivations, he quoted this verse from Nagarjuna: "It is stupid to discard disgusting filth into a golden jeweled container. It is even more stupid for a person to sin after being born a human. You should listen to this teaching only after setting your motives. Setting your motives properly and talking the right manner. The Dharma you are about to hear is Dharma that will take the fortunate to the level of the Buddhas." Then Rinpoche referred back to the headings he had already covered. The fourth major heading of the Lamrim is the sequence in which the disciples are to be taught and the actual instructions. And this heading has two subdivisions. The first of this tells how to devote yourself properly to spiritual guide. There are six preparatory rites that have already followed, have to be followed in this particular practice. I have been teaching these six preparatory rites in concise discourse. And so when Master Tsongkhapa was actually being successful in his study, and so Manjushri told him that mere study will not give you realizations, but you have to actually become a hermit, and so you should go. And then Manjushri was told that while Tsongkhapa was actually being helpful to so many people by teaching them and also the Dharma, how would that, how about not going up to hermitage? And Manjushri said whether he would be beneficial to the Dharma and sentient beings or not, I would know it, and therefore he must go to up to the hills. And then at that time, Dongden Jambe Gyatso was taking only juniper seeds for his meals, diet. And Jerembuche took some tsampa to the point that the tsampa was just enough for to last during his retreat. And Dongden Jambe Gyatso, because of taking these juniper seeds as his meal, he was known as Lama Shugdrupa, the Lama who was who took the juniper seeds. And then Jerem Buche actually had this vision of Master's Manjushri and his other disciples, he actually found the realization of emptiness, as we find mentioned in his mystical biography. And so in the earlier on, before that realization, Master Tsongkhapa had actually said that when your mind is just settled on no thoughtlessness, then that is when you actually have found the view of emptiness. But later on, when he actually asked Manjushri which Madhyamaka view he has, the Savatantrika or the Prasangika, Manjushri said, "None of these." And then Manjushri gave some very terse teaching, and Master Tsongkhapa said, "I don't understand what you are saying. I can't comprehend your words." And Master Manjushri told him, "It doesn't matter. You go to meditation up in the hills, and then you will have the conditions for realizing emptiness in time. You'll meet with the right conditions." And therefore, in his three principal aspects of the path, Master Tsongkhapa says, when you destroy all... when you see that infallibility of the samsara and nirvana, and also...
Um,
And then you actually are able to destroy objectification of things. That is when you actually find the view of Madhyamaka. And then he makes a distinction between finding the view of Madhyamaka and actually being able to be decisive in this in terms of completing his analysis of emptiness. And then Master Tsongkhapa later on in the text says, in the three principal aspects of the path, when you don't have to alternate between the appearance and the emptiness, it's, no sooner you think about emptiness, your mind switches also to the conventional and so forth. Then you have actually completed your analysis. And so, Master, in the vision of Master Tsongkhapa, where he was said to have seen the five masters of India, Nagarjuna and so forth, the four of them are called same, but there's a version which says the fifth one is either Bhavviveka or Buddha Nagabodhi. And so, Master Tsongkhapa also had this vision of a bluish pandita with a text in his hand, touching it on his Tsongkhapa's head. And so, Master Buddha Palita, it's on. So one of these disciples in the vision, Buddha Palita, blessed Tsongkhapa by placing Tsongkhapa's on Tsongkhapa's head a Sanskrit copy of Buddha Palita's own commentary, The Pursuit of Buddhahood. And so many of our students, monk students, do memorize different texts. How many of you actually have memorized Lekshe Nyingpo? Essence of True Eloquence, differentiating between definitive and provisional teachings of the Buddha. And so, raise your hands, his answer. Perhaps most of you have memorized Abhisamaya Alamkara and Madhyamaka Avatara. Please raise your hands if you have. Are you not students of philosophy? Some of you are not raising your hands. So we talk about, with regard to Abhisamaya, ornament, in terms of the word ornament, we have this saying that this ornament is actually adorned me with lies and lies. Then those of you who have memorized the Tsao Shirap, the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, as I said before, it is a very important text. And so there are few of you very good who have memorized this Mula Madhyamaka Karika. So when Tongbun Rinpoche used to teach the commentary to the Mula Madhyamaka Karika by Master Tsongkhapa, the ocean of reasonings, he actually used to make his disciples memorize the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, the root text itself. And although, again, I received this transmission teaching of the commentary by Master Tsongkhapa, the Ocean of Reasoning from Gen Yima, he gave me exception. So I do reflect on this text often, and it really moves me and helps me. And so there are Westerners also who do know about this text, the Mula Madhyamaka Karika. So Buddha Palita blessed Tsongkhapa with a copy of Sanskrit, a copy of Buddha Palita's own commentary, The Pursuit of Buddhahood. So in the 18th chapter, where it's Mula Madhyamaka Karika, The commentary of Madhya Buddha Palita has a commentary to the verse where it says, if the Tathagata were the aggregates and so forth, at that point, and in relation to that point of the commentary, Tsongkhapa had a desire to read this commentary and to common appearances while going over the 18th chapter. He developed realization into the stainless view of the Prasangikas. How many of you have actually memorized the second chapter of Brahmanavartika? Raise your hands. There's one, and another one, a second one. He had read this commentary many times before, but to common appearances, this time his mental stream was ripe for this kind of realization. And so there are, I think, three or four of them who raised their hands. So that's very good. Very good. As Gungdar Rinpoche had said, you have to rely on the words for meaning. So without memorizing the classic text, but just being able to recite it and kill your day will not do. And so we have this marvelous tradition of memorizing the root text and then reading the commentaries, word by word, and then also analyzing the text, the meaning, and so forth through debate and logic in the debating courtyards. So there are many such incidents in life stories of other saints. Tenzin Gyatsang is one of the lineage gurus of this Dharma. One day he was about to go to Drungpa village in Dakpo for reading of the scripture in somebody's house. He asked Gyatsang Kedo to give him a book to take to read. He was given a copy of much loved Kadampa anthology, which contained a virtual song based on the mind training practice. As soon as Gyatsang Tenzin read it, he developed a genuine bodhicitta in his mind stream. The next day, while he was petitioning the merit field, during his preparatory rites, he came to the section that invokes the names of authors of the Lamrim. This passage begins, "You virtuous ones who lovingly care for all sentient beings." At that moment, when he invoked the names of these authors, they say he felt a vivid burning sensation in his forehead. Thus, when one's mind stream is ripe enough, one will suddenly develop realization with ease from even the most trivial circumstances, as Dolpo Rinpoche has said. While you accumulate your collections of merit and purify yourself of obscurations, think that you are conscientiously petitioning your gurus and deities. Even though you think these things will never happen, not in 100 years, they will happen. This is so for all conditioned phenomena. They do not remain static. And the saints of the past traditionally gave this oral instruction. You are like a seed without moisture when you do not build up a stock of merit. Thus accumulation, self-verification, and petitioning the merit fields are crucial. People in great monasteries do not merely debate all the time. They also do lots of chanting during their assemblies, debating practice, daily recitation, and so on. One must take these things seriously. Their point is accumulation and purification. Whom do you petition in order to accumulate merit and purify yourself? Do you petition the merit field? The meditation on the merit field is therefore vital and has been made into a separate heading. The term merit field means that this visualization is a fertile field for building up your stock of merit. People value an ordinary field that produces good crops. The merit field gives great force to your accumulation, self-purification, and petitioning. You must therefore take seriously the visualization of this field of merit. An ordinary field will only produce a few bushels. The merit field will produce results of immeasurable energy from the tiny seeds. So we finished. Oh, yeah.